Hello, everyone. Thanks for being with us this evening here at the NGV. I'm Matthew Bush. I'm a research fellow in the East Asia program at the Lowy Institute. And I'd like to welcome you to our panel discussion tonight on Thailand's triple threat, culture, politics, security. It's a discussion of a forthcoming paper by Dr. Nicholas Farrelly by the same title. And we're going to have a discussion this evening of that paper. So thanks for joining us. And before I begin and introduce the panel, I'd also like to give a special thanks to the Department of Premier and Cabinet here in Victoria, who are the Lowy Institute's partner here in Victoria, and they help make programming like this available in Melbourne. So thank you to Department of Premier and Cabinet. I'd like to quickly introduce the panel before we get started. First on my left here is Dr. Nicholas Farrelly. He's the author of the paper. He's also the Deputy Director for Impact and Engagement at the Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at the ANU College of Asia and the Pacific. His research focuses on government control, spatial organization, and political conflict in Southeast Asia. And he works extensively on Thailand and Myanmar, and he co-founded the New Mandala website, which is a prominent online forum for discussion of Southeast Asian politics. On his left is Dr. Tyrrell Habercorn, who's a research fellow at the ANU College of the Asia and Pacific. Her work focuses on Thailand and on the tradition of past and present state violence, and she argues that impunity for violence is a key factor in state formation in Thailand. She has a forthcoming book on this subject called In Plain Sight, Impunity and Human Rights. It's going to be published by the University of Wisconsin. And I'm sad to say, actually, that Tyrrell is soon leaving Australia to take up a position at the University of Wisconsin as Associate Professor of Asian Languages and Culture. On her left, Mr. Sunai Pasuk. He's Senior Researcher on Thailand at Human Rights Watch. He's an expert in the political, security, and foreign policy dimensions of human rights and democratization in Thailand and Myanmar. He has carried out in-depth research on violence and human rights in the southern border provinces. And before Human Rights Watch, he worked as an advisor at the Thai Senate Council on Foreign Affairs. Finally, on the end is Professor John Blaxland, who's professor in international security and intelligence studies. He's director at the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, and he's the head of ANU's Strategic and Defense Studies Center. He's former director of Joint Intelligence Operations at Headquarters Joint Operations Command. He also was formerly Australia's defense attaché to Thailand and Myanmar, and his research interests include intelligence and security, Australian military history and strategy, and international relations in Southeast Asia. From the Lowy Institute, thank you to all of you for being with us tonight. And all of you traveled, so thank you especially for that. To start off, I'd like to ask Nick to just give us a bit of a 3-minute overview of the paper and tell us a bit about the triple threat and what it is and why it's sort of important to discuss now.
Thanks very much, Matt. And thank you, of course, to the Lowy Institute for putting on this evening's event, and to the Department of Premier and Cabinet for all of their support. This paper has its genesis in my own anxieties about how it is that Thailand's travelling, what the last decade of upheaval and turbulence will mean for the very long term, and how it is that a new compact or consensus might emerge. The triple threat, in a nutshell, as you'd expect, has three components, and let's step ourselves through them one by one. First, the triple threat is about the elevation of Crown Prince Vajiralongkorn to the Chakri throne. And of course, his father held the position of King of Thailand from 1946 through until October 2016. That was an historic reign for so long. There have been whispers that the Crown Prince, the new king, would be unsuitable to follow in his father's footsteps. And of course, this makes it very difficult for the king. I have no doubt that he is aware of the challenges that he faces in terms of bringing the Thai people with him, and of course also building legitimacy among the international community. So that's the first element of the triple threat. How is it that Thailand's sacred and pinnacle institution is going to handle the elevation of the new king? The second element of the triple threat relates to the entrenchment, or perhaps the re-entrenchment, of military rule. Thailand, as we're all aware, has a very long history of direct military intervention in politics, most recently with the coup of May 2014. And what I suggest in this paper is that we need to look very closely at the priorities of the Prayut government. We need to be thinking hard about how it is that this particular flavour of dictatorship is different to what we've seen in the past. And of course, we need to be looking at it side by side with the changes inside Thailand's palaces. The third element of the triple threat is the one that I'd suggest tends outside Thailand to get the least attention. This is about what's going on in the southernmost provinces, most acutely in Yala, Pattani and Narathiwat. And these are three provinces where, of course, since the early 2000s, we've seen a very significant new wave of conflict. Perhaps 7,000 people have been killed over those years, and yet nobody outside the country pays much attention. And even in Thailand, you know, when you get to provinces like Nakhon Si Thammarat or Chumphon, and then up to Bangkok and to the north and the northeast, the southern fire is a very distant concern. And for most Thais, it has only bred apathy as the conflict has persisted. So you take these three elements together, and I think in terms of culture, when it comes to the palace, in terms of politics with the armed forces, and of course with respect to security in the deep south, there is a confluence of issues that we need to take seriously. We need to wonder about the sustainability of this arrangement, and we need to think hard about the kinds of choices that the Thai people will be making in the years ahead.
Thanks, Nick. One thing I wanted to do was go to you, Terrell, because I think this intersects a bit with some of your research and expertise. The triple threat is about, it's about security and politics, and we've heard how it should influence the way that we think about Thailand, but how does it influence the way that Thai citizens experience being Thai, and how does it influence the way that civil society functions within Thailand?
Thanks, Matt. I think, and as Nick already began to highlight with respect to the Deep South, what's so powerful about this analytic of the triple threat is that it captures very succinctly the confluence of factors that impact security and make Thailand less secure and less stable. What seems to be very clear, in addition to the loss of life in the South over the past 13 years, is that over the last 3 years since the coup, the first two factors, the monarchy and the entrenched dictatorship, have had a profound impact on civil society, on freedom of thought, of freedom of expression, and that's been evidenced in increased skyrocketing prosecutions for His Majesty, for sedition, for public assembly. And it strikes me as thinking in the long term that the negative effects on civil society and on people to express their views and in a sense have the opportunity to participate in the governing of the polity are yet another aspect of the negative effect.
Thanks for that. Sunai, this question of the situation in the South, you're sort of a great expert on this and someone who monitors the situation there very closely. And as Nick informed us, it's a conflict that we don't think about that much outside of Thailand, even though over the last 12 years it's resulted in a great loss of life, including many civilians. Could you tell us a bit about what sort of is the driving force behind this conflict and how it relates to political dimensions of the triple threat?
Right. Yeah, thanks. The conflict in the Deep South, yes, it has been going on since 2004, claiming nearly 7,000 lives, 90% or even more civilians from Buddhist population and ethnic Malay Muslim. And this conflict is about armed separatist group from ethnic Malay Muslim population who are seeking to separate their territory from the control of Bangkok. That is the aim. They do not share pan-Islamist agenda of Jemaah Islamiyah or Daesh. This is a homegrown insurgency. That is the first kind of the first foundation of the armed conflict there. Secondly, this armed insurgency is not supported by the majority of ethnic Malayu Muslim population who live in the Deep South too, because they too are affected by violence. They too cannot bear with the brutality and human rights violations committed by these separatists. But they are unhappy with mistreatment, injustice, impunity enjoyed by Thai government, particularly the military, which has been going on for decades there. The change of government, particularly the coup in 2014, has significant effect on the trajectory of conflict in the Deep South. As I said, majority of Muslims in the Deep South do not share the same objective of armed separatist group. But they want to get even, they want to get attention from the Thai state through participatory democratic process. They turn out in large number in every level of election, from village election to national election, thinking that by making their voices heard through ballots, they will get attention from central government. But what happened right after the coup? The military shut down that venue first. Secondly, Muslims in the Deep South think that they can have their identity recognized culturally, politically, and economically through constitutional process. And up until the coup in 2014, those processes were recognized as permissible within constitutional frameworks. Self-governance, provincial governance was possible. What the junta did immediately after the coup, they stopped debate in every form about self-governance, about decentralization. The only narrative left in town in the Deep South on the ground is armed struggle. So that feed into radicalization, that feed into the belief that it's pointless to engage through political process anymore. It feed into recruitment and indoctrination of insurgency. It's not helping. So the coup is perhaps, you know, the most negative effect to the radicalization and the increase of insurgent violence in the Deep South.
So is there a perception of those drivers in Bangkok? Is there a strategy for addressing it?
Well, this kind of the military government right now, they still think that by using military force, they can weaken insurgents to the point that they would surrender. This is kind of, you know, just one-sided analysis that the Thai has greater military strength, so military approach is the right approach. And also by doing heart and mind, addressing grievances of the Muslim, it means that the military will have to admit their own faults, that there were human rights violations happened at the hands of the military. They will have to be held accountable. And that is not acceptable to the military. And last point I would say that, you know, up until now, we can say that the rest of Thailand and the rest of the world do not pay much attention to violence in the Deep South. But you have to recognize a new fact. The conflict is no longer contained to those border provinces next to Malaysia anymore. Last year, on the birthday of the Queen of Thailand, insurgents bombed tourist destination Phuket, Phanga, Krabi, Hua Hin. They were bombed by the insurgents and using the Queen's birthday as the marking point that they now have the capacity to shake up Thai society. They now have the capacity to harm foreign confidence in Thailand, and it will have daily effect on tourists who visit Thailand, including Australians. And before that, there was other bombs at Samui, which is another important tourist destination, very popular. That was bombed by the insurgent as well, but the Thai authority tried to keep this low-key. But my point here is that insurgents have the capacity to cross the boundary of the Deep South, to hit other parts of Thailand, to hit where that is sensitive to tourists, that will hurt the foreigners. So the question is when they will hit again and when they will try to move the attacks beyond just getting the headline, just getting attention, to causing real casualties.
Do you agree with that, Nick? Because I know this is addressed in the paper about violence sort of moving out of the traditional battlegrounds. Would you agree with that characterization? Is this part of a deliberate sort of strategy to broaden this conflict?
I think what's remarkable about the conflict in southernmost Thailand is that it has been constrained or contained for so very long, because under most conditions, a separatist insurgency of the type that we see in southernmost Thailand would have struck out more regularly to attack targets of opportunity, and there's no doubt that other provinces in southern Thailand present such targets. It hasn't been part of the strategy of the leadership, who are quite literally calling the shots, but if they determined that the strategy needed to change for whatever reason, and with the two other prongs of the triple threat in mind, one could imagine that their strategists are considering or have considered alternatives. And I think that's where Sunai is making some very powerful points about the risks, not only for Thailand, but for anybody who is seeking to do business or pleasure in the country.
John, I'd like to go to you, because it seems as if part of the strategy has been sort of avoiding association with any sort of global jihadi movement, even though Islam is part of the Malay identity there, and also sort of avoiding efforts to make this a more regional issue. So it has international relations dimensions within ASEAN. And so I wonder if you could just speak a bit about that and where you see what's happened and if there's a sort of change in the future.
Thank you, Matt. Yes, it's... The point's been made, but it's worth reiterating that the situation in southern Thailand is distinct. It is not Mindanao. It is not looking to take on any Daesh-like aspirations. It is thankfully not infused with a Wahhabist, jihadist, violent jihadist mindset. In fact, it's surprisingly resilient to overtures from violent jihadists, Wahhabi jihadists, who have made entreaties to the southern insurgents to engage them. Now, there's a couple of explanations for this. One is that the insurgents want to keep it a local affair, and this is one of the compelling reasons why they haven't actually gone outside the borders except for last year. And I think there are some extenuating circumstances about last year that suggest why that might have happened. And I think that would indicate that perhaps that was an exception to the rule and likely not to be repeated as a trend. Mm. We haven't seen it, thankfully, as a trend in the last year since then. Conversely, the Thai military don't want to internationalise this. And back in the days when George W. was going around talking about the so-called GWAT, the Global War on Terror, they were hunting around, looking at the insurgency in southern Thailand, looking to see if it fit the template, so they can, you know, put the American military template on it. And of course, it didn't fit. Thankfully, it didn't fit, and that remains the case. And the Thai military are actually pretty keen for that to remain the case as well. So there is an incentive on both sides, of both the insurgents and on the Thai military, for this not to be internationalized, and that's one of the reasons why it has kind of festered below the international crisis radar scope threshold, if you like, for 13 years, 7,000 people killed, without generating that kind of international reaction that you would see in Palestine, for instance, were that to be the case. It just, there are internal dynamics that may keep it at bay. Interestingly enough, of course, the insurgents have not articulated, the equivalent to the Communist Manifesto. There's no political statement out there saying what they actually want, which would give the military grounds for articulating a policy position and negotiating. Negotiating with what? It's really difficult for them to grab onto something to talk to. Mm-hmm. It's frustrating as hell for them. And that's I think a deliberate ploy, because over the and you think about this as in over a span of decades, if not centuries, when insurgents have actually put their head above the parapet, literally if not metaphorically, they've had it lopped off. So you know, there's been moments of rapprochement. There's been moments of, you know, some kind of peace agreement. Lo and behold, it unravels, and all of a sudden, you know, the leadership suddenly disappears. So there is an incentive for the current crop of insurgent leaders to actually not be identified, and that's understandable. On the other side, the Thai military and the Thai government has an incentive to not let this go, one of which is the oil and gas reserves in the exclusive economic zone that is directly contiguous with the southern Patani-related provinces of Yala, Naratiwat and Patani. But similarly, also this concern about the potential fracturing of this Thai state, and Nick touches on this in his paper, the concern about perhaps there being something equivalent in the northeast in Isan. And there is certainly, you know, the Thai state has very much always been a unitary one with central control from Bangkok, I say always, in the modern era. Mm-hmm. Because of this desire by the government in Bangkok to assert central control. Because we don't forget, in the 70s and 80s, there was considerable insurgency when Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia were going through the wars, the Indochina Wars. At the tail end of that, in particular, Thailand went through considerable insurgency, experience of insurgency, and the Thai military responded to that. It's not very widely known in Australia, but the campaigns in Thailand, in the northeast of Thailand in particular, and in southern Thailand, which generate the kind of issues that Tyrrell's written about, actually were substantial military campaigns. We're not aware of that. And that sits in the back of the consciousness of the Thai elite about the concerns about the fracturing of the Thai state. This is reflected in the southern Thai situation.
I think one thing that's worth also bearing mention of is that Thailand is... being governed by the Thai military at the moment. And so in some ways, is it possible that the Thai military has divided priorities, not just sort of security, but also governing and also politics? Yeah. And sort of is it difficult to forge political settlements, not just in the south, but of any kind, given that situation?
You know, it's very interesting, the contrast of 2017 to 1997. 1997 was a year of the most liberal constitution ever seen in mainland Southeast Asia, an extraordinary document that was seen as a moment of great hope and progress and a pointer to Thailand having a bright, open, liberal, democratic future. Thaksin came along and took some liberties that effectively undermined the elite's confidence in that option being sustainable and viable in the longer term. I'm not saying it's all Thaksin's fault, but he has a significant role to play in that equation that while people, I know he has his defenders, his detractors are not without merit. So to simply say Thaksin's a good guy, the military's a bad guy, is to overly reduce a more complex situation into black and white options. Sure. That's not true.
Nick, what do you think about the idea of the sort of liberal constitution in 1997, Thailand's journey since then, how it relates to the new constitution earlier this year, and what sort of a political system we're likely to see at some point in the future?
My working assumption is that long-term Thailand moves back towards the regional norm, and the regional norm is for some flavour of non-democratic or semi-democratic arrangement whereby establishment interests are prioritised above almost anything else. Mm. And as a consequence, Democrats find themselves squeezed, often out of the serious conversations. My personal perspective is that Thailand could do better much better than the systems of authoritarianism that have proved so incredibly robust elsewhere across the region. And yet the trends at the moment, for me at least, suggest that Thailand is now heading back in the direction that Myanmar used to be, just at the time that Myanmar is swirling towards something which could, over the decades ahead, become one of Southeast Asia's most important political stories.
So I want to go to you, John, on the sort of regional norm idea.
Yeah, now I think there's a point here about what's happening in the four mainland Southeast Asian Theravada Buddhist countries. Let's remember what they are: Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia. In that mix, Thailand has been a paragon of virtue, relatively speaking, if you like, in terms of its liberal democratic norms since in the post-97 period. And I would challenge Nick's perspective on the prospects for Myanmar. My sense is, and I'm open to be challenged on this, but my sense is that the roadmap to democracy that was mapped out in 2003 reached its end point in 2010. They have accomplished their mission. The Tatmadaw, the military, remain in control. They have no plans at all to progress beyond where they are. And ironically, Myanmar's received incredible plaudits. And mission's been accomplished, by the way. The mission, I would argue, this is my hypothesis, the mission was to lift sanctions, to grow the pie so that the Tatmadaw could thrive more. And that has been accomplished. The sanctions have been lifted. The Tatmadaw is thriving more. The Tatmadaw still controls the budget, external defence, national security, and the West thinks it's a wonderful democratic country. Ironically, it looks remarkably like Thailand. Thailand has gone the opposite direction from being this liberal democratic country of 1997 to now being considered repressive, and yet in many ways it's uncannily similar to Myanmar.
Do sort of perceptions matter, though, in that? Like, is it a risk for Thailand if they're perceived this way? And does that sort of exercise the government?
Indeed. What has changed, though, since 1997 is that the winds of liberal change are waning globally. In the face of the rise of a single-party state, China, in the rise of a quasi-fascist Putin, in the face of the Trump phenomenon and the Brexit phenomenon, the pressures on Thailand to return to the 1997 norm have faded enormously, and Thailand understandably looks around its neighbourhood and thinks, you know what, we actually are pretty happy with this. And the other thing, you know, one of the things that is on the minds of officials, it's not talked about because people don't like talking about it, but it is on their minds, is that this is a, you know, and Nick has touched on it in the paper, there is a degree of fragility to the current order. There's no question there is a degree of fragility, but the institutions, the national security institutions, are working assiduously to mitigate the risk of that, mindful of three kind of phenomena: 1789, 1917, and the Arab Spring. This is so in their consciousness, when you talk about wanting to liberalize towards what? And there is a sense in the establishment in Bangkok that's a palpable concern, a palpable fear, that if you give in, if you cave, if you back off without this regime, with the Rama the 10th reign consolidated, without the mechanisms locked in, then you potentially face something that is far uglier than has already been witnessed. Mm. Now, how accurate that is largely inconsequential because it's a felt need.
Sure. Let's talk a bit about sort of this consolidation that you touched on and which you discuss in the paper. But I might ask Tyrell or Sunay if you wanted to talk a bit about the royal succession and just what that sort of means in the context of the Thai polity and what it means to talk about consolidation and how that has an impact on sort of other questions of governance. And
shall I start?
One thing which is interesting, if we look at comments by leaders of political parties and movements in Bangkok recently, there is now a vision of following the wish of King Rama X about unity of the nation, as has become a new motto. And that, interestingly, was reflected, too, in a comment by the U.S. ambassador to Thailand, Glyn Davey, who said, you know, reconciliation should be the top priority before finding a fixed date for a general election. So there's kind of a new consensus is emerging that, you know, you can fix a return to democracy later. Now let's get all these conflicting factions in Thai politics to live together. The question is, do they live together voluntarily out of the free will, or they are being forced? The concerns that you know, for groups such as Human Rights Watch have is that, you know, now it seems to be they are going to be put together in a pen and then given with a contract drafted by the military. It is actually, there's such thing called a contract that is drafted in a monologue by the military that every political movement and political parties will have to sign. It has binding, and this will dictate the future of Thailand. But given, you know, the discussion that we have here, what you might have seen in the news, what happened in 2010 and other street protests in Bangkok, the phenomenon that Thai people show up in large number to take part in an election. So how long will this social contract hold? And yes, you might be able to deal with leaders of movement, but what about the memberships? What about the supporters? Those people have gone through a moment of political awakening. Can they be put back in the tin? No, I don't think so. So they should work with kind of multi-pronged approach instead of like addressing the concerns that I agree with John, that they have that concern, those concerns in the back of their head. But using coercion is not going to be a working or a sustainable, I would say, it is not going to be a sustainable working formula. It might work in a short-term period, but in the long run, they need to relax the grip. That's what I would say. And there is another thing which we haven't mentioned tonight is that the military has a vision. Nick talked a bit about, you know, comparing with Myanmar and John too. The Thai military has a vision to have their legacy continue for another 20 years through what they call a reform strategy. It is now being passed into a law that will render election promises meaningless. Because no matter what party win in the future or what form of the government will emerge in the future, everyone in the government and in the parliament are obligated to follow this 20-year plan. Otherwise, they could be taken to court, could be impeached. So what's the point of making promises to your constituency? Because you have to follow the will of the general, not the will of your own constituency, not the will of your voters.
To pick up on both Sunai's comments about the military's unwillingness to let go of the reins, and also on John's comment about the fears related to 1789 and 1917, I would urge everyone to look at a series of recent events which may seem marginal, but actually I think speak a great deal to the profound concern, both the profound concerns held by the monarchy, but also the profound interference or potential interference in politics and the polity that's taking place. This past Saturday was the 85th anniversary of the end of absolute monarchy in Thailand. There was, and every year, the day is celebrated not only by historians and supporters of democracy, also the families of the People's Party, the coalition of military and civilians who launched the transformation from absolute to constitutional monarchy. Since the coup, it's been a day where local police and also military intelligence follow closely what takes place. But this year in particular, there was a clampdown on what could be said, where it could be said, and in particular, what those who raised questions about the meaning of that day were allowed to do. And to just, again, to, I would say everybody go home and Google this story, because there's a lot more than we have time to talk about here. But at the place where those figures, the People's Party, announced the transformation from absolute to constitutional monarchy at the location in Bangkok, there was a commemorative plaque about the size of a sewer cover placed in the road. That plaque disappeared mysteriously in early April. Those who have attempted to ask questions about who removed the plaque have been arrested and held incommunicado in military detention. Those who have raised questions about it on social media are potentially facing prosecution for lèse majesté. I don't have the answer of who removed the plaque, but the series of things that have happened to those in Thailand who have questioned this suggest we should be thinking about who, why, and what it signifies.
In some ways, we're talking about a constitution that's from 1997, it's just 20 years ago, it's the Asian financial crisis, something that I study. It's a long time. There are sort of generational changes that take place in two decades. So, Nick, do you think there are generational changes that are related to cleavages in Thai politics? I've read that sort of most of the traditional red shirt, yellow shirt protesters are all over 50. So what do sort of young people think about this, and or are they sort of disinterested?
I think, Matt, they're all on Facebook.
Right.
And they're far from disinterested, though. There's a huge amount of political discussion that goes on. And, of course, if there wasn't a concern, we wouldn't have seen, as we did earlier this year, the remarkable situation where senior Thai government spokespeople were warning the citizenry about having any online interactions with three foreign-based critics of the current military regime. That's a situation that suggests to me that there's a great deal of movement and indeed perhaps momentum among those who are asking these powerful questions that Tyrrell has brought to our attention this evening. Thai politics isn't over, and young people are playing constructive roles, some of whom, of course, we should remind ourselves on a night like tonight, have taken very brave steps, which have then seen them incarcerated for long periods of time. These are people who don't get written about in our media. In fact, they tend to rarely get a mention in their own media, and yet their struggle goes on. And as Thailand continues through this difficult and complex phase, we need to pay as much attention as we possibly can to the sorts of activities that they are committing their lives to.
Mm-hmm. And if I may add that, the generation question is in the attention of both sides, that Nick talked about this kind of the pro-democracy side and liberal side. But for the generals, they too try to reshape the thinking in Thai society through education, starting from very young age, to the point that General Prayut, the junta leader himself, has coined 12 values that students from kindergarten are compelled to recite every day. It has become a motto, 12 good things to do, nothing to do with democracy, of course, but be obedient, follow the order, be good citizens. That shows that, it's kind of to make sure that the growing generation will follow the narrative of each side. Mm. That one is more natural kind of evolutionary approach that, it becomes trend that no one can stop. But from the conservative side, it is more of a coercive force support from above as directive from the junta at every school ought to follow.
I think there's a point that's worth noting here, that there is a lot of what is being done by the military is done in the context of a deep malaise within Thai politics that saw a very indulgent and not terribly noble approach to politics by Thai politicians. It's not like, I mean, we're kind of pretty critical of our own politicians, but in Australia we have by and large quite ethical politicians. Thailand's politicians have by and large been, they've set a remarkably low bar, right? And I know from my discussions with some senior military officers that while we may not like how they've done it, they by and large have done it with good motives, and they've done it mindful of incredibly profound corruption that they've witnessed in the political system. Now, I know that there's corruption still there, and that it's power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, and I think General Prayut kind of gets that too, which is why I do believe he will go back to elections. But he, my sense is that there is a deep cynicism in the ability of Thai politicians to actually generate, drive the country in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know Thaksin has his followers, but his detractors have a pretty compelling argument. And it applies across the political spectrum. The opposites, you know, the Vejajivas, the people who support the Democrat Party, incredibly profound and widespread corruption that generated. So it's easy from afar to be very critical of the Thai military for what they do, but I think we need to be mindful of the circumstances they face, how they view the world, the circumstances that they seek to address. Now, there's no question that, you know, they could do things differently, and in private conversations I encourage that. One of the things, when you think about what the Australian government can do, how we can engage, there's interesting dynamics at work. The United States, for instance, under President Obama, was very outspoken, but publicly outspoken in criticising the Thai authorities for what they do. And my sense is it actually had the opposite effect to the intended, because it drove them into greater indignation, greater protection of their position, whereas the Australian approach has been actually criticised in the media for not being critical enough.
Correct.
But in fact, in private, has been quite critical, but constructively critical, and been respected for that by the people in authority. So I just caution against being too sanctimonious and too judgmental about people who, by and large, are trying in circumstances that are remarkably different to ours to make a system work.
I think that's a, thank you for that. I think that's a nice place to bring our conversation here to a close, but to open it up to questions from the audience here this evening. Couple rules for a good question. Please identify yourself. Please keep it brief, and please make sure it ends in a question mark. There's two mics that'll be roaming around, so if you just wait for the mic to reach you. So if anyone has questions for any, all, some of the panelists, how about right here? That was the first hand that I saw. So,
my name's Mike Angley, and I apologise in advance that this question may be from a very naive point of view, but I'm interested, superficially looking at Thailand, I see sort of no influence of Buddhism in the way public policy is developed and the way society works, and I wondered why that is.
I'll have a crack.
Okay.
No, you go first.
You go first.
Yeah. I would say that it profoundly influences how policy is shaped. Their view of the world is starkly different to the post-Judeo-Christian worldview of Australians. Starkly different. And it is premised, and I know there are those who would disagree with me, and it's a contentious point of view, but I would argue that Buddhism profoundly shapes their worldview, profoundly. And in fact, understanding how Buddhism influences their thinking is very helpful in discerning what they mean when they say what they say, when they implement policies that they do. And key to that, I would argue, and this is a potted interpretation, if you like, of the significance of Buddhism to the Thai body politic, is the profound influence of the belief of reincarnation. And in that system, in the Thai political system, almost universally, and there are some people who will play it down, but by and large, even the most Western educated elite profoundly believe in reincarnation. That shapes how you view the world. Because the idea, you know, we in the West talk about, yeah, you only live once. Well, that is a nonsensical concept to a Buddhist. It is complete nonsense to think you only live once. Of course, you have multiple lives. Right? And if you have multiple lives, you are therefore a product of your previous lives. And if you are in the elite, you deserve to be there. Okay? That is a profound shaper of thinking. You deserve it. And if you're a beggar on the street, equally, you deserve it. What did you do in your last life, you scumbag? Right? What did you do to deserve this? What kind of low life were you? Who did you murder? Right? These are the kind of things that people think about when they walk past the beggar. We in the West think, poor sod, let's give him 20 baht, right? That's what we do, because our view, our worldview is profoundly different. So when we think about Thai politics, if you don't think through a Thai Buddhist prism, you completely misconstrue what you're seeing, I believe.
Interesting.
Right. John already said what I wanted to say.
I may take two questions at a time, just because I know this we're short of time and there are probably a lot of questions. So perhaps here, and then the gentleman in the back.
Sorry. Since 2014 coup, Thailand has been moving towards China. So China is now Thailand's leading trading partner, their second biggest source of foreign investment. They've been performing joint exercises since 2015, and Thailand's currently buying 3 submarines and 10 tanks off of China. They also sent the one China policy. And so does this kind of lead to a conclusion that Thailand would be in China's sphere of influence in some sort of, you know, kind of great power conflict? Okay. And, you know, if we kind of look at Thailand and the Philippines as being kind of dominoes in kind of some sort of Cold War domino theory, except with China as opposed to the Soviet Union, what are the security implications for Australia over, you know, the next 20, 30 years of kind of some sort of Thucydidean trap has kind of sprung? Or
great.
Is that the other thing?
Thank you for that. Do you still have a question back there, sir? No. Let's go right here.
Good evening. I'm Pon Panjan Gajang. I'm actually a diplomat. I'm from Royal Thai Machine, Canberra. First of all, this is not a question. It's rather a comment, if I may, but I'm trying to keep it short.
Okay. Well, if you could keep it short, that would be great. And if you have a question, that would be even better.
Okay. Well, I do appreciate Lowy to hold a seminar such as this, because it still reflects that Australian community is very interested in our country, which is I highly appreciate it. On political development, I do understand a lot of your concern. Some of you may wonder whether Thailand will go back to a full democracy. But I mean, for me, if you were to look at Thailand in a Western concept of democracy, it would be like putting an ND filter in your camera lens, and all you will see is darker images. But if I were to suggest you to replace your ND filter with a UV clear filter, you would have seen that there are a lot of progress have been made, especially since 2014. We were shocked that the military took control, but they actually did a lot of things. A lot of law have been put in place to ensure stability. We cannot ignore the fact why military came in. We have to to accept that back then we kind of faced political impasse, violence were spreading out, government could not function. So it's kind of reasonable. And if you talk to the Thai people, some of them will welcome military presence because there was no other option back then.
Okay.
And on human rights situation...
I'm sorry. I think that we reflected quite a variety of opinions this evening. And so if you have a question, I'm happy to hear that. But if not, I'm going to ask to move on to someone with a question.
My question would be to Nick. If you were to compare, if you were so concerned about the Thai monarchy and the role of monarchy and how the new reign will affect democracy, what do you compare with the Australian community that back then, I remember as a student, they were asked to join a republic and majority of the people would no, even though there's quite distance between, physical distance between the Australian community and Queen. And how would you compare the Thai community that we have been born with monarchy since the creation of our country, do you think that we will ever abandon that institution that is a pillar of our stability? How do you compare with that?
Thank you. You want to take the parallels between the Republican movement and monarchy in Thailand?
I'd love to, and yeah. I very much thank the representative from the Royal Thai Embassy in Canberra for the comments and also for the questions. I think you'll all agree that it's wonderful that we can have an open, frank and reasonable discussion of these important issues for Australia, for Thailand and for so many other countries. I'll keep my response brief. The Australian people, as you say, were given an opportunity almost 20 years ago to consider whether a republic would be a better model for this country, and in their wisdom, determined that at that time, such a model wasn't going to fit Australian conditions. The Thai people are now, and I would guess for a long time to come, not going to get a say on the political model that governs Thai affairs. For now, it's very clear that most of Thailand's established powerful interests have come in behind the monarchy. They see their interests as aligning with that institution. At some stage, that, though, could change. And monarchies, of course, often look like they are permanent fixtures until they're not. The Thai monarchy clearly offers a great deal to many millions of people in Thailand. And I hope that in the future, there are opportunities for more Thai voices to have a say on exactly what kind of political arrangements are best going to serve their needs.
I might go to the China question, but would you like to take that question quickly, John?
Just on the royal one first and then on China.
Yeah.
I think we in Australia don't quite understand how profoundly the Thais feel about their monarchy. The Thai embassy representative touched on that, but it is palpable. And it goes back, you know, this the long lineage of multiple lines of kings going back to the Sukhothai era, if not beyond. There's a very proud history of that, that we don't quite understand because Australia is such a young country as a European transplanted political institution. Not saying Australia is not old, but the construct we live in at the moment is very young. So for us, it's actually, you know, we're quite cavalier about Queen Elizabeth. The Thais are not at all cavalier about Bhumibol or Vajiralongkorn. It's just we actually don't understand, really, by and large, we don't understand that phenomenon. My sense is, by and large, Thais are very, very sensitive to that, to being offended on that because of the sensitivities of that. And there are people who get into trouble on Lese Majeste issues, and there's no question Lese Majeste is pretty darn draconian. But there's a converse, which is this actually floats in Thailand. It works in Thailand. By and large, people want it, my sense is. On the China question, this is a very interesting one. I'm doing a study on Thailand and China at the moment, and I don't think it's at all an open and shut case. it's pretty evident to me that the Thais very much appreciate their relationship with the United States, their relationship with ASEAN, which is a virtual great power, is actually fundamental to their self-conception. ASEAN is of remarkable importance and political utility to Thailand. People who poo-poo ASEAN do so at their peril, I would argue. The Thais have a long and proud history of playing off great powers. So this idea that China is going to somehow have Thailand wrapped around its little finger, I think it's misconceived. That is not the Thai way. The Thais have a long tradition of buying military equipment off whatever deal they can get. They've had Thai tanks since the 1970s. Let's not get our knickers in the knot about buying the cheapest subs they could get from China on a cut-price deal. It's not unreasonable. No one else is giving them remotely that kind of deal. Lots of other people, the Malaysians buy Chinese stuff, lots of people buy Chinese stuff. It doesn't mean that they are politically beholden to China. I just think you need to make a distinction. And Thailand, like many countries in ASEAN, is invested in a couple of things. Invested in English. English is the lingua franca of ASEAN. That's big.
Mm.
They're invested in American procedures, equipment, and relationships. Enormously invested. The relationship with China pales by comparison. I'll leave it there.
If I may add on the China issue from human rights perspective, there is one concern, though. China is now demanding the privileges that Thailand used to give to the U.S. when it comes to secret rendition.
Right.
Grabbing of dissidents who live in exile in Thailand with UN SCR status as refugees. Mm-hmm. It has happened since military coup that there has been a secret deal between the Thai authority and China in handing over these dissidents, more than 100 Uyghurs who would surely face torture and persecution at the hand of Chinese authority, were sent back to China regardless of protests from UN and most of major Western embassies in Bangkok. It happened nonetheless. Mm. Activists who live in exile were grabbed and then ended up like quietly in China.
Mm.
This is something that, you know, we need to be worried about. It's not that Thailand will turn into a satellite state of China, but it is more from China's side that is, you know, what Thailand used to give to the US in the past, China want to get the same deal.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of their privileges.
Perhaps a reminder to Australia of the sort of importance of staying engaged in the region and
Continuing
to promote its values with its partners in ASEAN. With great regret, I unfortunately have to bring this panel to a close. But first, I'd like to invite my colleague, Michael Lamasik, from the Department of Premier and Cabinet, to give a word of thanks.
Hi, everyone, and thank you, Matt, and thank you to the panel, to Nicholas, to Tyrrell, to Sunai, and to John. That was a very interesting discussion, which I very much enjoyed. This is the second in a series of joint events between Lowy and DPC that we're proud to support. The Victorian government is very engaged in international engagement. We have 20 offices around the world, including 3 in Southeast Asia. We're very engaged in building people-to-people links. We're very engaged in building trade and investment links as well. I very much enjoyed tonight's discussion. It explored some really complex issues, but some interesting ones, and I hope you all found it informative as well. Could you please join me in thanking the panel tonight?